Hey, it's Tuck Ross, and you're listening to Social Currency. Social Currency is the marketing podcast covering the hottest digital and social media marketing topics that matter for your business strategy now. I'm your host, Tuck Ross, and with me is Jessica Jensen. You can find us at Tuck Ross and at Jessica K. Jensen on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Get everything Social Currency Show at socialcurrencyshow.com. Today, we're talking with Trisha Hershberger, digital content creator, social influencer, queen of geek culture, gaming and tech reviewer, online personality, and she has over 500,000 followers online. Is there anything that is not in the mix with Trisha? So here we go, dig in with this social media influencer as we talk about YouTube and how to become YouTube famous. Let's dig in.
So, I mean, I can imagine like your time is valuable. Again, you're a content creator. As you were explaining earlier, you're concepting, you're producing, you're editing, then you're distributing and doing all the marketing around a lot of this. So there's a huge value on your time. And so do you think that that big shift from an AdSense perspective and the kind of the decline in the monetization model with YouTube, did that then attract a lot of creators to working more closely with brands and companies to kind of do these collaborations and custom content?
I definitely think that it helped motivate people in that direction, because you would have creators before that were very, you know, this old school mentality of, I'm never going to sell out. I don't want to partner with a brand. Like, they saw it as really selling out and compromising their values creatively, and we're never going to be those people. And then when it was unsustainable, but you were like, wow, this is what I love, this is still what I want to do, how do I continue to make this my job? A lot of people looked at it as, you know, do I do sponsored content and partner with brands and just stick to brands that, you know, I 100% believe in and can get behind, but everyone was terrified that my audience is going to hate me if I do this. Or do I do community funding, which also, especially in the beginning, did not play well with audiences. If you were like, hey, I'm going to make the same great content I've been making for you for free, but now I'm going to ask for money. like that didn't go over great either, but you kind of had to find your way. And some communities responded better to one, some communities responded better to another. I think most creators now probably do a mixture of the two. Mm-hmm. I've told my YouTube community numerous times that I feel super weird asking my community for money to help fund my stuff. So I would rather personally partner with brands that I believe in to make higher quality content for them and have the budget to do that. In between, and I keep like my regularly programmed videos less, not less quality, but I mean a lower production value for sure. They're more like everyday videos. Because I get that creative need fulfilled for a lot of the programming that I produce for other major companies. So as you mentioned, I do a show with Newegg, I do a show with Kingston, I do a show with Geek & Sundry. And those are all major studios that have budget to make really high production quality stuff. So I feed that urge for myself there. But yeah, I told my community, like, I don't feel comfortable asking my community for money on YouTube because that's not how I was brought up on YouTube, which is hilarious because on Twitch, the platform has it built in that there's subscriptions, there's donations, but because that's so commonplace on the platform, it's part of that culture.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel weird.
Yeah. That totally makes sense.
Maybe if I had started creating on YouTube years later, when that was more commonplace, I would feel very differently about it. Because there's another mutual friend that I believe you know, but I work with him quite often, has a relatively new YouTube channel, and is under the million subscriber club, we'll say, in that range, and loves channel memberships, is doing great with it. Like, YouTube is his home base and his stuff is all community funded. And he tailors a lot of his content specifically to super chats and channel memberships and a lot of those community funding features that YouTube has incorporated in the past couple of years. And he's thrilled to be there.
Interesting.
So maybe it's just that I'm too old of a YouTube perspective.
That's really interesting culturally. Like you said, I mean, if Twitch has always been that way or for a long time has, it feels very natural to do that. And partly because everyone else is doing it, you're not an anomaly. And then also just your fans and followers expect that. So they're not upset about it either, or taken aback. But to your point, if you came into YouTube in the last, say, 2 to 3 years, that might feel very normal to you. And there might not be any concern at all about asking for contributions to the fund.
Right. Yeah. So like when YouTube first implemented the ability to tip a creator, none of your people used it. Unless you were tailoring your content to actively ask for tips, it just wasn't a part of that culture.
Yeah.
Whereas for Twitch, I never have to ask for donations or subscriptions. Like I never have a call to action asking for that stuff. And kind of the feeling on Twitch in general as a creator is it's never expected, but always appreciated.
Yeah.
Because it's such a part of the culture, you will get people that are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you just defeated that level. That was insanely hard. Here's $5. Good game.
Yeah.
Like it's, that's just part of it.
Yeah.
And there certainly are people who tailor their Twitch content specifically for asking for money. That's not how I roll, but there are definitely those people on any platform, I feel like. But yeah, it never sat well with me on YouTube, but I don't have a problem with it on Twitch, which is
hilarious. Well, and again, speaking of the way in which we become acculturated to a certain platform, or obviously even just the way in which the society we live in is behaving, you know, to your point about what's quote unquote normal. You know, I know a lot of they're called KOLs, key opinion leaders, right? We've probably heard that term. That's the equivalent of a social influencer in China. And a lot of the a lot of the KOLs in China on, you know, obviously WeChat is the predominant social platform over there. But those videos that you see, 100% people are sending them money, which I remember when I first saw that, and that was probably 3 or 4 years ago. So maybe that was as YouTube was also kind of coming into that space, perhaps. That seemed unbelievable to me. But what was even more interesting was that there would actually be these live videos where people would be sending in money and asking the creator, the influencer to do a certain thing. And again, you can only imagine, right? Like there's a beautiful girl and they're asking for her to twirl around in your pretty dress or blow me a kiss to the screen. And they would do it and they'd thank them and they would, you know, very specifically call them out and they would give them, you know, $20, the equivalent. It just always felt so peculiar to me, like as if you were almost like in a circus, you know, being asked.
Well, it really blurs the line between like webcam girl or webcam performer.
Yeah.
Where essentially people are giving money in exchange for you doing things.
Right.
Like, where is that line? I think Twitch has done a really good job of outlining what their terms of service are. And Twitch actually skews a lot more conservative on their terms of service than some of the other platforms. But I think it's because they have come face to face with exactly what you experienced watching these live performers start to be like a circus show for money. And then it becomes this very off-putting thing. And maybe that's just a Western culture thing because you said, you know, it works on WeChat. So
right. To each their own, I guess.
To each their own.
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is, I love this discussion. So I want to talk about if folks are listening and they've never worked with a content creator or a YouTuber or a social influencer, and they're hearing this, they're like, this sounds really interesting. Where do I begin? And I've gotten asked this question myself, and there's obviously never just one answer, but how in your experience have you found that brands have found you? How do they connect with you to even broach the conversation?
Most of them email me directly, and I assume that they have found my business email either on my YouTube page or on my Instagram page, or some people will Twitter DM me. But usually it's through my business email, which is on my website, it's on my YouTube channel, and it's on my Instagram page. And most people have them in a couple different places. Sometimes brands will contact my agent or my manager, which is publicly available information, who represents me. And sometimes I feel like they find me through a database, and there are a collection, I would say, of social media influencer databases.
Yep.
Where you can go in and say, I need someone between this age and this age, this gender with these interests, and it filters through and gives you a list of names. I assume that's how it works. I've never seen it from the brand side, but this is what I've been told. And, you know, and then people reach out to you to see if they can make something work. And then it always is kind of the fun conversation from the creator side of, does this person actually know what kind of content I make? Have they looked at anything I've done? Because like, especially you and I laughed about this earlier, Jess, that especially when I announced that I was going to 3D print a tiny human. And by that, I mean actually give birth to a human for anyone listening. I'm sorry, I have a very weird sense of humor.
I knew what you were talking about.
Thank you. Yes, when I announced I was 3D printing a tiny human to the public, I had so many like, make a dedicated YouTube video for our bottle warmer companies. And this was not a smart bottle warmer or anything that could remotely fit in the tech or video game sphere. It was just straight mom stuff. Mm-hmm. Or when I'm reached out to by beauty companies where I know they just wanted women in a certain age range and they looked at my numbers and hit me up, to which I kindly usually write back that, you know, I have an 80% male audience and I don't really think I'm the right influencer. Like, I don't think you're going to get the conversions you're looking for, even if I did put this out to my audience, but best of luck on your campaign. And I actually, and people are like, you go a step too far, but I try to offer them other influencers I know that might be interested. So I'm like, I can connect you with people much better suited for your brand than me, because I know these people are just trying to do their job. And if I can make their, if I can help make their lives easier and simultaneously get some of my friends paid, I am down to be that connector. Like, I feel like that's just good karma. That'll come back someday. It's great.
So you're getting a combination, then you're getting some folks who, I would imagine it's a spectrum, some folks who have clearly watched your content, have researched you, and they're, you know, sending you a personal email or a DM. You know, hey, Trisha, I'd love to talk more about the great content you make for my brand. You know, do you have time next Wednesday or whatever? And then you're getting folks on the other end of the spectrum who perhaps found you in a database of influencers and maybe haven't even actually watched your content. And they're just sort of almost kind of spammy, like almost a generic form letter. Do you get those kind of emails?
All the time. Wow. All the time. Dear YouTuber, they start with dear YouTuber, love your content, would love to work with you. Here's the link to my brand. Let me know if you're interested and respond with, the funniest is when you have no relationship with them and they're like, respond with a screenshot of your impressions. They're like, I don't know you. I'm not giving you that. What?
Right. Show me your data. You're like, we haven't gone on a date yet.
What does I look like? Take me out to dinner first, okay?
Right. Buy me a drink.
But, you know, again, and then there are the people that reach out that it actually does become a working relationship. And with the people that it is wonderful to partner with, a lot of times you end up repeat partnering with the same people because you find you have a good working relationship, et cetera.
Yeah. So it sounds like if there was a recommendation to make for folks listening who maybe haven't worked with someone like you before, it would be however they stumble upon you, whether it's through a database or it's just through organic searching of social platforms and YouTube, spend some time researching your content, making sure that you are talking about the topics they're interested in that align with their brand, and then perhaps send a more personal email or reach out in a more personal way to try to open that conversation up.
Yeah, I mean, making it personal is definitely a great pointer, but I would even say that's extra credit. That's going above and beyond. The biggest pointers I would give if you're going to reach out to someone is to try to just wrap your head around what the content creator's job and process looks like. Sometimes you get reached out to by brands that they make you feel like you're just going to snap a selfie and post it. And you should be very lucky that they're working with you because your job is so easy. And that's a clear miscommunication and misunderstanding of everything that's entailed in the process. So that usually is a clear deal breaker for me because that means this is going to be a brand that's incredibly difficult to work with.
And
that's a big one. So understand what the creators' processes and respect that process, try to respect what they do for a living. And then, yeah, if you can make it personal on top of that, and you know that your brand already has a connection with this influencer, like you believe it would genuinely be a good fit, right. Even if you don't know this person at all personally, believing the brand's a good fit and respecting the process and collaboration, that instantly puts brands in the top 10% of the emails I get. And I would also say, understand that branded content deals and influencer marketing is huge now. And no matter what level of influencer you're reaching out to, they are getting tons of these emails a day.
Yeah.
So when I get a brand that reaches out, that's like, don't worry, I'll give you my $20 product for free. And in exchange, I want 3 dedicated posts. And you're like, what world do you live in that someone says yes to this? But I guess there must be people out there that say yes to it eventually. And those companies are probably playing a numbers game.
Yeah.
Just to see eventually someone will say yes. But yeah, that making it personal, having a good brand fit, and having respect for the creator you're working with instantly puts an email in the top 10%.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I also think to your point about, you know, hey, I'll send you my $20 product and you can, you know, post 3 times, you're welcome. I think the tables have turned in my experience because, you know, influencer marketing, and again, I know that word is kind of contentious, but I'll just use that for the sake of something easy. Influencer marketing has been around actually for a really long time. I mean, not as long as the internet has been around, but, you know, over a decade, I've been observing this phenomenon kind of bubble and grow. And I think recently it's become so much more sophisticated and mature that, you know, to your point, the power, I believe, sits much more with the influencer community, with the maker community and the content creators, because A, they've gotten, as you have, really good at making quality content that speaks to their audience. B, it's much more authentic than anything, frankly, that a brand can ever do, because we aren't people, we're companies, and you're an individual. And then lastly, you have reach. You have an audience that believes in you and will, you know, perk up and listen to what you have to say, which again, we might have those things on the brand side, but it's not the same relationship that you guys have with your followers.
Yeah, I would say the power dynamic is, and from my perspective, it's probably more like a 50-50.
Balanced.
But creators are very protective of their communities because that's their whole livelihood.
Yep.
They've worked really hard to build that community. So it is this very guarded, no, you can't have my people.
Right.
Like, this needs to be a give and take relationship. You can't just come in here and flash money in my face and get my audience. That's my audience that I've spent years cultivating and building. Are you crazy?
Right.
But then that being said, if the brands aren't reaching out in the first place, then there's no collaboration to be had. So I really do believe that it's a pretty equal give and take to make it work on a very successful level. Also, a lot of influencers, and this is why so many influencers hate the word influencer, because a lot of the people to gain the community that they've built have done that by doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that is that they do, whether it's modeling, photography, gaming creation or gaming streams, whatever it is that they do, that's a revenue stream for them as well. So I think when a lot of brands come in and they're like, well, you need my money. Surprise, content creators don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. It helps fund so we can make better content.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know anyone personally that solely exists and pays their rent on influencer marketing.
Right. Like, you have other revenue streams.
Yeah. And because you have to, like, what did you do to get that community in the first place?
Right.
You did something to build that audience in the first place. Like, I mean, Oprah Winfrey arguably is the world's best influencer.
Right.
You know, because she has more influence than anybody else.
Right.
But what did Oprah do to get that influence?
Yeah.
That's her career. That's what she does. Anything on top of that is just extra bonus.
Yeah. And I've always felt, tell me what you think, but I've always felt like part of the pain with the word influencer is, you know, if you go to introduce yourself to someone at a party, it's probably unlikely you're going to say, hi, my name is Trisha Hershberger and I'm an influencer. Because it inherently carries this sort, it's a loaded word, right? And I feel like you'd be much more apt to say, I'm a content creator, you know, or I'm a maker, or I'm a gamer, or whatever. Because that's a little, like to your point, it's a little bit more about what you've actually contributed and what you're doing to add to your audience's betterment of their life, if you will, or enjoyment and entertainment. And the influence is sort of this secondary factor.
Right.
What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. I usually tell people, I either, depending on the situation that I'm in, I either say that I'm a digital content creator, or I say that I am an on-camera host in the tech and gaming and fandom spheres.
Yeah.
Because when I look at my QuickBooks P&L at the end of the year, my main revenue stream comes from my on-camera hosting work. That's my bread and butter. That's my career. That's what I do.
Yeah.
Anything else is extra to that.
Yeah.
Whether that be revenue from my personal YouTube channel, my personal Twitch channel, any influencer work I've done, et cetera. And it just so happens that all of the professional hosting that I do is usually also stuff that I have a hand in production or pre-production or am also involved with in other spheres, because it's digital, it's the digital world.
Right.
And in the digital content world, things are not as compartmentalized as they are in the traditional content world.
For sure.
So you're asked to wear many hats.
Yeah.
But people seem to understand that better when you're like, oh, I'm an on-camera host that does tech and gaming. People know what that is.
Yeah.
When you say I'm a digital content creator, people don't, unless they're in the industry, they don't really know how to
interpret
figure that out. And I think same thing if you say I'm an influencer. It's just not specific enough. It's like, okay, cool, you do that, but what else?
Yeah. Again, that's what I was thinking too. It's being an influencer is almost this sort of ancillary or kind of like a result of this other stuff that you've done. That's again, like you said, how you've grown an audience, and then now therefore you have influence, which you can do all kinds of other things with if you choose.
Yeah, it's almost like introducing yourself and saying, like in the traditional entertainment world, going up to someone at a party and saying, I'm a famous person.
Right. It's like, okay.
Okay.
How did you get famous? What did you do?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's great. So I want to just ask you one last question, and then I know we should wrap up, and I'll kind of close on our final three that we always ask folks. I know that you talked a little bit about kind of this rise in geek culture. You know, this, we've heard these terms, geek is the new black and chic geek and all these things that have kind of floated around in memes the last few years. And I've seen it too, being on the brand side, working in the tech industry over the last 8 years or so, it's become much cooler to be into tech. And I would love to get your perspective, especially as a female creator and gamer, which I know still today is kind of the minority, about maybe what it was like to be into those things when you were, say, a teenager, or, you know, kind of moving to LA, for example, versus what it feels like to be in that space today.
Oh, it's radically different. So growing up, a lot of the things I was interested in, either you didn't talk about publicly because you would get shunned for them, or you made the decision that, you know what, then I'm just going to be the weird kid and it's fine. I tended to be totally okay with being the weird kid and being the loner, or having only a few friends, and those friends were guys. That's just, I was like, well, you know what? Fine. If you think I'm weird for liking the things that I like, then really what's that say about you? I mean, I was definitely that kid, which did not lead to being popular in any way, shape, or form. I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons as a kid. That was not something you talked about. And, you know, so I came up and I was like, hey, whatever, I'm going to do me, because that's who I am. And you only get one life and this is me. And so then as I got older, still being very much myself, in this world where the things that I liked just happened to become posh. it was laughable. It was very funny. But it was so, it's been so wonderful, because I am of the feeling that the people who picked on me back in the day and made my life really hard because of the things I was passionate about, if those things had been as, not only mainstream, because I don't mean popular, but I just mean as well known then, as they are now, I think I probably would not have gotten picked on nearly as much. Mm-hmm. Even if people were aware of what it was, but thought, oh, it's not for me. That's better than, oh, what's that weird thing? You're that person that's into that weird stuff. Mm-hmm. And now that's not the case. So kids growing up today, if they want to be into that stuff, it's crazy that now like Comic-Con on the banners at San Diego Comic-Con says a celebration of the popular arts. Mm. Like that's mind blowing to me that these are the popular arts now. Like you said, it's cool to be into tech. We've got, you know, organizations like Girls Who Code and Women in STEM. Like all this stuff that is being supported, and gaming even is pretty 50-50 split as far as gamers. Now, granted, that skews based on the genre of game that you're playing and the platform of game that you're playing. But as these things are becoming more well-known and more in the general zeitgeist, more people have the freedom to say, oh, maybe that is for me. Whereas before, they either weren't introduced from it to it or were intentionally excluded from it for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But now we have that option.
Yeah.
So if it's something that piques your interest, regardless of your gender, your age, your orientation, whatever, you can do that thing.
Yeah.
You can be free to like what you like. And you'll still get a knee-jerk reaction from some people that weren't necessarily expecting you to be you when they see you or hear you or whatnot. But it's such a different world now. Like the reaction that I got back in the day when I would say that, like in grade school, when I would say that I played video games, or in high school, when I would say that I played Dungeons and Dragons or Magic the Gathering, versus now when I say, oh, I'm a Twitch streamer. It's now it's met with like, oh my gosh, tell me more about that. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Whereas back then it was, ew, you what?
Right.
So yeah, it is most definitely changed. And I know some people feel very protective of, you know, if I had to struggle through to like this thing, then you should have to struggle through to like it too. But I don't feel like that. I feel like open arms, inclusion, the more the merrier, because A, I am not complaining at all about the fact that we have so many fantasy television shows coming out right now. I am not complaining at all about the fact that we have so much comic genre film and television that's beautifully done.
Game of Thrones.
That D&D is at a all of it. Yes.
Right.
To me, I'm like, man, what, like we are living in the golden age of liking things traditionally deemed very nerdy, to the point now where the word nerd and geek don't even hold the same connotation. No. They used to be derogatory. And now some people use it as a badge of pride.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people still have mixed feelings about it though. It's very funny.
Well, if you think back, like there's that movie in the 80s, probably the early 80s called Revenge of the Nerds. Mm-hmm. And I was very young when it came out, and you probably weren't born quite yet. And so something to go back and watch and laugh at. But I think back to like the reputation and these terrible stereotypes we had around that word nerd. And, you know, frankly, I think the tech industry and the folks that have come up as these CEOs now, right? The leadership out of companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon and Microsoft and all those folks that we hear about every day in the news, you know, all those guys would have been considered in that category when they were younger, and look at them now. And I think that's really helped to propel this notion of, you know what, it might not be so bad to be kind of smart and into technology, because look what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I get so many people now that were way cooler than me in high school reaching out on Facebook or whatnot to ask me for phone advice or tell me what's wrong with their computer to see if I have any idea of how to fix it. Like, it's very, very funny.
It's got to feel so good. And, you know, honestly, I give you so much credit too, because I feel like we all know, like in middle school, especially that period of time, it's so hard to be different, no matter what the different might, again, whether it is the way you look or the things you're interested in or your family structure or whatever's going on. I mean, I know I moved around a lot as a kid. So just being the new kid, that alone made you different. And so I give you so much credit for having such a strength of character and the integrity to go, you know what? Screw you guys. I'm playing D&D and either you're in or you're out. And like, look at today, look at how much it's changed to today.
Yeah, it has worked out for me in the long run.
I'd but say
it
so.
It definitely made my youth pretty tricky.
I'd say it definitely worked out. So, all right. So Tricia Hershberger, digital content creator, social influencer. I'm going to deem you queen of geek culture. And that's a huge compliment. I want to wrap on three fun questions that kind of give us a fun picture of what's going on in your life. And we ask these of most of our guests. So number one, what book are you reading right now?
I am reading the comic book Fables Volume 2. Now, Fables is an older comic series that has been out for a while, but it's one that I only recently got into. And because it's an older comic, it's really hard to find Volume 2 in print. You can get it digitally now, but I like to hold my comic books. I like to, you know, read them in the bathtub or read them on the beach or whatnot. And my wonderful husband for my birthday this last year was able to find a printed version of Fables Volume 2.
Awesome.
So that's what I'm reading right now.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah, super, super fun. If you like, it's a very, for anyone who's thinking about picking up a new comic book series, or just if you are, it is fairy tale characters living in New York City in a very, very dark, gritty world. So it is not a kid's comic. You hear fairy tale characters and think kids, not for kids. Mm. In fact, there are a lot of people who think that the television show Once Upon a Time was a ripoff of the Fables comic series.
Interesting. Okay. I will have to check that out. And I feel like if I ever get into that genre, you're the first person I'm going to ask for recommendations.
The closest, I got you.
I feel like you would totally have me. I know very little about that genre, but I know it's, again, like a mecca of, there's such a passion around that. And super cool to find kind of an out of print edition of something as well. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. Number two, your favorite source for staying up to date on digital social trends, kind of where do you get your inspiration from?
The Social Currency Podcast.
Oh, good answer.
Obviously. I honestly wish that I had a direct resource to get all my news for that kind of stuff, but I don't.
Oh,
everything that I learn by being in it.
Yeah.
Being elbow deep in it. Some platforms, like I said, I got an email from Twitch that there's a change coming up. Some platforms are better about communicating with their creators before they do a change. But normally I am learning by living in it. And I feel like by the time people are writing about the changes, I've already figured them out or known that something was changing, but not known exactly what it was. I have a lot of friends like yourself, Jess, that work in social media. And so a lot of it is word of mouth from friends that work in this industry that'll say, hey, I just went to, you know, Facebook just had this conference that I went to that was very inside baseball and they're changing this, this, and this. It's going to happen in 2 months.
Yep.
Like sometimes I get that word of mouth, but most of it is just being there.
Yeah. Well, and I think
if you know of a place that publishes, hey, here's the changes that are coming, please let me know because that would make my life so much easier.
Well, and I was just going to add the one that I've started to really pay attention to is called The Strategist. Mm. It's a kind of a combo of social media, content marketing, which obviously bleed very much into each other. And so it's not going to get into like the nitty gritty of, the profile picture shape is going to change or the platform is going to do this to the algorithm. But it talks a lot about, again, content strategy, you know, whether it's why we should serialize content or, again, the difference between something feeling personal in a vertical format versus not, or even more philosophical kind of future forward trends in digital and content creation. So I like The Strategist a lot, but I think you have the huge advantage that many of us on the quote unquote brand side don't, where you are in it. Like you said, you're a maker. And so you learn by doing, and you probably know enough to write your own book and have your own, blog just about the content creation process. You just don't have time right now to do that. That can be your next career.
Maybe someday. Maybe it's someday. That's actually why a lot of content creators consult.
Yeah.
Because they don't have time to write a book.
Yeah.
But for people that need the information that they are super up to date on, they're like, well, sure, I'm happy to sit down with you for an hour or two. Here's my hourly consulting rate.
100%. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of the online training courses pop up for everything, right? Like you can take that for, you know, investment strategy, parenting, you know, like how to repair your car, anything you want to learn. Obviously, you can learn online, but I would imagine that could totally be another revenue stream, or maybe it's your sunset career, if you will. Once you want to do something different, you could consult on all these things that you've learned around content strategy.
Yeah, I think that's everyone's idea of what their sunset career is going to be.
Yeah.
I'm too old, but I don't want to vlog about, you know, whatever happened yesterday, or I don't want to have my face on camera anymore, or whatever it is. When I don't want to do this anymore, maybe I'll just consult.
I hear that a lot. I love it. You and I should go into business together. We'll do that like in 20 years. We'll call each other up.
Perfect. Yeah. I love it.
Okay. Last question, and we'll close on this. So again, thinking about leaders or folks in on the business side, the brand side, that maybe aren't quite as deep into digital as we might be. Certainly you are. What's one piece of advice that you'd give them to kind of figure it out or approach digital and social marketing differently?
I would say to never say never. Try not to go into anything with a preconceived notion of how it's going to come out, because this world is so different. Not only are the platforms different, each community is different, each creator is different. And I feel like anytime I have gone into something with an expectation of, oh, this will never work, or this is exactly how this is going to go, I have been wildly wrong. So it's one of those, it is the wild, wild west right now. And you have to go into it with a kind of hold on to your butts attitude, because you don't know where it's going to go. But if you're game to be along for the ride, if you have that improvisational yes and style, yes, to how you're working, then I think you stand to gain so much more and benefit so much more from this world.
I love that. Yeah, that whole yes and strategy, that is such a fundamental piece of improv that I call on myself often, because sometimes it's the hardest thing to do not to just shut stuff down. And so that, yeah, I hear you say, you know, be open to experimentation, be open to things maybe iterating and not quite going on a linear path, but you never know what you might get in the end.
Right. That's it.
Great advice. Thank you, Tricia. This was so fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yay! Everyone can easily figure this out, but I just want you to say it out loud. Where can people find you?
See, and I don't think everyone can figure it out, but thank you for saying that. I always feel like they're, you know, when people are like, I'm so sorry, I don't know who you are. I'm like, that is 100% okay. There are so many creators out there. It's totally fine if you've never stumbled across my stuff. So you can find me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at that GRL Trish. So it's like that girl Trish, but there's no I in the girl, that GRL Trish. And you can find me on YouTube and Twitch / Tricia Hershberger, which is just my name. And it's the last name is spelled just phonetically as it sounds. It's all E's. And yeah, it's been a wild ride, and I try to communicate on each platform in their own voice and in their own style. But if you are into gaming, whether it be tabletop or video games, if you are into tech, whether it be smartphones, particularly I tend to skew Android, or PC building, PC modding, PC gaming, that's all within my realm. And then just fun fandom stuff too. If you want to hit me up to discuss Avengers Endgame or how Game of Thrones should have ended, you can do that a million times over. And I'm happy to have that conversation.
Yeah, I feel like I'm the only person on the planet that doesn't watch Game of Thrones and kind of regretting it now. So
hot. Read the books.
Yes.
Read the books.
I'll start with that. There you go. That's your book recommendation right there. Just start with,
yes,
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. Although the first one is a bit of a slog until you get hooked. So that's the case with a lot of fantasy literature, though.
Yeah.
You got to trudge through a whole bunch of details before you get to exciting stuff.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on the Social Currency. I will just let folks listening know if they want any more Social Currency, we'd love to have you come visit us at socialcurrencyshow.com. You can subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, all those good places. You can, of course, hear from us directly if you sign up for our newsletter at info@socialcurrencyshow.com. And although I was solo tonight, you can certainly follow my co-host Tuck Ross at Tuck Ross in all of those social media places, or find me at Jessica K. Jensen. And again, Trish, thanks so much. It was great chatting with you.
You too. Thank you so much for having me. And please tell Tuck that I am sorry that I missed him.
Absolutely. Take care. Bye, everyone.
Bye.